annoying about the medium of advertising that they're exploiting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of genius. It's very frustrating. But it's, I think especially, I think the most, like, YouTube is annoying because of how frequent the ads are. Like, it's like we're just going to, like pump so many in here that it's, like, basically, they're right getting on the cusp of making watching YouTube videos without a premium service unwatchable, right? Because it's so, it breaks up your content so much and all this kind of stuff, right? It's just so annoying. But I think that the streaming services one is, like, the most obviously egregious because, again, they are the things that they choose to advertise are themselves. It's it's the products that you have actually already purchased being like, oh, basically like, oh, great. Like you've got Paramount, whatever. Look at all this cool stuff that you can get. But like here, you got to wait till you can get back to your show. But let us show you some other shows. And it's like, I already have these. Like, this is so clearly, like, this isn't about showing me stuff. This is about trying to basically, you know, pump me into, like, purchasing a higher level.
Yeah. Well, I do think, so it's interesting. I think that this is a really good avenue to take it because there's something, like, concrete and kind of more immediate than this explanation. But you have to remember, too, what made advertising what it is today. And I'm referring to when we were discussing Edward Bernays, right? The ads, Edward Bernays's approach to doing public relations and advertising is actually still compatible with, like, I don't know, like, let's say you buy access to, like, a streaming service, like, what is the Criterion Collection, right? And then you're watching their movies and you get an ad for Criterion Collection. And you, on the one hand, it's like, well, if you were trying to sell me something, this would be really useless. That's true, but advertisements are doing more than just selling you something, right? The other thing that advertisement is doing is constructing a fantasy so that you can have a desire placed within that fantasy, because a fantasy is like a horizon. So, like, if horizons structure meaning, fantasies are like the horizons for desires, right? You have to have a kind of loose context within which to desire. And once you construct that fantasy through advertising, a kind of libidinal landscape, now you as an individual can construct desires within this. It's a kind of intelligible, appetitive system, right? So, let's go back to the Criterion Collection. You're watching the Criterion Collection and you get an advertisement for the Criterion Collection. Well, there's something that the Criterion Collection says about you. And so we're going to continue to prop up the fact that consuming products is an appetitive thing. It's something that feeds into our desires. But now we're going to install a particular version of what it means to be a consumer of Criterion Collection. You are the suave, informed cinema viewer. Your choices are selective. You know quality when you watch it. You recommend the best films to friends and family. This is what it means to consume our product. And that is completely compatible with running an advertisement within Criterion Collection. In fact, it makes a lot of sense. I will state the quandary. I have it as a question, but then I have I like that these quandaries usually come out of, like, you know, we bump into advertising or something like that. They come out of, like, our experience. So my quandary as a question is, when an event ends an event, what is the relation of that concluding event to the concluded event? So something happens.
I was just going to say, Hume would say there's no relationship. You're just making that up.
Oh yeah. Well, that when I get to my example of what kind of events I'm talking about, you'll absolutely agree that this is all made up. It's all completely constructed, because I'm going to go on to talk about decade zeitgeist, specifically the 90s. So we have an event, and events arise because of other events, right? Now, certain events end other events, but there's a question about, okay, well, if that event ends the event, is it a part of the event? Is it not a part of it, really? And I'm going to think specifically the case I want to bring up is the 90s, whatever that means to whatever, whoever's listening, right? Now, I've always kind of had this, like, I don't know what it is, but ever since I was young, I've always kind of been interested in this idea of, like, the decade zeitgeist. So there was, like, the 50s, and then there was the 60s, and then there was the 70s and stuff like that. And I remember, like, that was probably, like, one of the, like, I don't know how young I was when I asked my mom about this, but it's like, you know, why are there decades? Like, why is the 60s different than the 70s? And my mom said, you know, people just get bored every 10 years and they just change it up. And I think that satisfied me for a while. But then I really started to see, like, oh, well, you know, things impact the way that people see the world and what they want and stuff like that, technology or, you know, world events. In this case, I think it's world events, specifically with the 90s. So the 90s begins and ends. It has, you know, it has a certain kind of vibe to it. I don't know specifically when the 90s begins. I'm going to guess.
Do you know, I was going to ask, I was going to ask, do you know, sorry, but do you know when the 90s ends?
Absolutely, 100%.
I have a feeling we have the same answer. What's your answer for when the 90s ends?
The 90s ended at 8:46 a.m. on a Tuesday, September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, that's, I think that's the general, that's like, that's the, I don't want to say it's like the correct answer, but I'm going to say in this case, I think that's the correct answer.
I see, I think it's the correct answer because there's nothing of the 90s that survives 9/11. After 9/11, there is, as we would say today, a vibe shift, right? There's not an iota of the 90s that survives 9/11. Now, what's interesting is I want to contrast the end of the 90s with another event, because I think that there's two events that kind of speak to the end of the 90s zeitgeist. One of them, I think, is more definitively 9/11. But there's something, I was thinking about this, when was it? I have it. It was August 31st, 1997. Do you know what happened then?
August, is that Diana?
Yeah, it's the death of Princess Diana.
Yeah.
So Princess Diana dies. Yeah, so what's really interesting, though, is because none of these land on, like, December 31st, 1999, so... Yeah. Worse, you know, there isn't something about the 90s ending that has to do with the calendar. It's about the zeitgeist. What's really interesting is the death of Princess Diana is in 1997, but it's really interesting because I don't think that presents a problem as it being a end of the end of the 90s, because in a certain way it begins the ending of the 90s. But my quandary has to do with the relationship of that beginning of the end, because while Princess Diana's death does signal or start the feeling of the death of the 90s, it has a different relationship to that ending than 9/11. For me, I kind of see 9/11 as like this flash, instantaneous, kind of binary, okay, the 90s are over. There's no question about whether the 90s is over. Like, at this moment, we're anticipating the invasion of Iraq and stuff like that. But with Princess Diana, her death kind of is, even though it ends the night, it starts the end of the 90s, but the ending is a constitutive part of the 90s, right? This was the most probably, and is probably still is, the most watched event ever televised.
Yeah, they ever televised like event. Yeah. And I think that I this is actually a super interesting topic and one I really enjoy thinking about, because I agree. Like, I think that the initial answer is 9/11. It is now, but the relationship can be like these, you know, zeitgeists, the kind of, you know, we call it the vibe, the feeling of an era or whatever, they can have constituent parts, right? So, like, I think what 9/11 signals was a shift in the sociopolitical shift, right? It's the end of the American exceptional era, like the 90s, the 80s and 90s, but especially the 90s is really this era of, you know, American Western exceptionalism. There's this kind of You know, you hear people, especially current with current political trends, my God, you hear people talking about how the 90s was this sort of like era of statesmanship and stability and neoliberalism. And, you know, when the West is sort of like coalesced as the, you know, you have these like relatively functional, economically successful, safe democratic states, and they're leading the way, and you know, and nothing, there's no third party, there's no you know, alternative, right, to this kind of form of life, this socioeconomic, this political way. And then obviously 9/11 cuts that hard, and you actually see, not only does it present like a new enemy, but more importantly, it creates a dramatic shift in the psychology of power and politics and socioeconomic relations for all these, for states and for people, right? You get the, you know, kind of get into the 2000s, you know, paranoia, and you know, you kind of, you start to enter this era, especially with having some new technology of, you know, the surveillance state and all these sorts of things, right? So I think that's one thing. But then you go to Diana and you think, well, what is the big thing there? And I think that there's more of a personal shift, right? Like the 90s kind of had a little bit more sincerity, I think, in its individual members and cultural features, right? And, you know, Diana really represents this as this person of great, like, social, cultural power and influence, but who also represented, who was someone who is kind of seen as like, you know, very genuine and humble and relatable and not super particularly personally power hungry, and just kind of like thrown into the little self kind of thing. And people just, you know, kind of love her because of how authentic and real and genuine she is. And then this person sort of died. Well, that's sort of, they do. They die kind of out of nowhere and young. And I think that you kind of see a trajectory away from that kind of more authentic, you know, social hero to something more flashy, something more, a little bit more, you know, we maybe replace Diana with Britney Spears, a little bit more producty, a little bit more materialist. Well, not a little bit more, a lot more materialistic, which is ironic because Princess Diana was princess. So it's like, I don't know, like how much more materialistic can you get? But it's more like the focus on who their character, interests, style, presentation to the world becomes. They become much more like, you know, who those people are and what they're about becomes much more product focused, right? And less character. If I was to introduce a beginning to the 90s, I personally might say that guy Zeitgeist might be taking away, kind of back, sort of talking in a way what Diane ended, would be the death of Diane ended, would be the release of Nevermind by Nirvana in 1991, which was a real shift both in the music scene, but also in, you know, what a rock star was, what music was about. You know, also shifts from the sort of like California, you see kind of a shift away from California being the sort of culture in California, New York culture epicenter, to like briefly it being like Washington, it's like Seattle and Oregon. That's kind of like, you know, more like kind of like post-punk, you know, anti-Pacific, but also this kind of more anti-materialistic, more poetic, more self, you know, self-deprecating, you know, but also more like kind of sincere and all this kind of stuff, right? And you know, obviously the grunge movement doesn't last a super long time because like a bunch of people die. But again, I think that's a good point of saying like, okay, well, that's where you start to see this sort of like unique 90s era that we now, obviously a big issue as well, is we now sort of like reflect back and reconstruct these stories, right? We reconstruct the vibe, reconstruct the feeling of these certain eras and decades and stuff like that.
Nevermind as the kind of beginning of the 90s, because I was kind of contemplating whether the 90s begins with any, because like I think I also like that you bring up Nevermind, because I think that's more to your musical tastes, is rock and grunge. I myself am very much like an electronic music, you know, EDM kind of guy. And the 90s is essentially where this stuff starts taking off, right? But it's really hard to place it to a particular release. I don't think, because in rock, the album oriented format is still really prevalent for like radio play. But since electronic music is still very like, it hasn't been like polished in that way to like commercial releases, it's still very underground. There isn't one particular release that sets it off. If I had to say when the 90s began in terms of like electronic music, it would probably be the general event of the I think it's called the Summer of Love of 1989, where Acid House starts being played in the UK. So this is a kind of it's a kind of house music, which is like an electronic dance music that is coming out of Chicago. And it's having a particular sound to it. It's this very drippy, very kind of like spicy, almost techno sound put on top of house music. It almost sounds like techno, but it's not really techno technically. And it goes over to the UK, particularly Manchester, where it's getting played in these underground raves in like abandoned warehouses and stuff like that. But this sets it off all across Europe and gets electronic music really kind of going in all these festivals and whatnot. But it's interesting you bring that up, because I was thinking about that. I don't actually know. And I should say too, I think your introduction of like different kinds of dimensions to this is really important too, because when I was thinking about when the 90s begins, I was actually thinking of the Persian Gulf War. Because yes, because there's some, I don't know what it is about, like, even culturally too, like for me, imagining American soldiers in helicopters wearing that cookie dough camouflage, you know, that has like the
with
spots.
With the burning oil and by the oil fields burning in the background.
Exactly.
Stuff like that. Yeah.
Exactly. That's very, very that, 90s.
You know what? That's actually a really good one. Whether we transpose, and you know what? I'm just going to take a little break and say both, I think Brandon and I are both enjoying this conversation. We're cognizant of time. There was some other stuff we wanted to talk about, but I think we're going to free form it and just like carry on with this convo, because it's been great. And it's been got some interesting stuff coming on. That's sometimes how philosophical thought goes and how we both learn and do philosophy. And we'll talk about that more next time. But exactly. It's a little demonstration. It's how, sometimes philosophers get sidetracked, but that's okay. Cause you go down all sorts of different rabbit holes, right? And you never know what you're going to find. And sometimes that's the most interesting and important and most illuminating stuff. But what I was going to say is I think that Desert Storm is a great example, because it's transposed against 9/11, right? I should have thought about this, because I actually think Nevermind is a good cultural and personal example transposed against, say, the death of Diana, because you also have Cobain come in there as this huge 90s cultural figure. And he obviously like dies in like 3 years after the album's release, but becomes this, you know, kind of icon of the 90s, transposed against Diana's death as well. Two very different people, but who had some overlapping characteristics and relationships with media and fame that I think people really resonate in terms of what the 90s means. But back to Desert Storm, you see a sort of interesting transposition against 9/11, where Desert Storm was this enormous success, right? Like it was the Americans bringing together a coalition of Western powers under the aegis of the UN, all this kind of like legalese and doing things the proper way, but still exercising mass military power and force, but doing so lawfully, unlike, you know, like previous states, like whether it be like the Third Reich or whatever, where it's like, you know, it's like kind of illegal invasions and all this kind of stuff. It's all draped in this like legality and this internationalism and this neoliberal idea. And they do this still Desert Storm thing and they kick butt and it's super successful. And, you know, and really the casualties for Western states are extremely low, not so low for Iraq, but they are like, for Western states, they're very, very low. Considering the size of the military operation, I know that they thought they were going to lose a lot more troops and it was going to be more of a serious fight. And in fact, it was not. And they were super successful, or at least initially. And that's really transposed against 9/11, right? Where you see this huge security, social failure within the context of the West being attacked by other individuals, kind of like from the, here's the thing, they're not related to the Baathist regime at all, but it's again coming out of the same for the same sort of very roughly same sort of part of the world and this kind of stuff, right? At least from the position of Westerners sort of thinking of the, you know, the their own events and times. And so I think that that kind of, you have these two sort of sides that really close each other out. Yeah, I think that they bookend each other very well. But I also think that in some ways, when we start to think about it, you know, that Desert Storm and all this sort of stuff betrays, you know, the, how do I say it? Some of the hidden problems with that, with the sort of 90s narrative, right? You know, particularly with, you know, a world that's in a very awkward position that's kind of hard to see at the time, but just like we're saying, where there is no, you know, as Mark Fisher would, if people like that would say, you know, there's no alternative to the capitalist, realist, neoliberal system, right? There's just like, they're just kind of out there operating. There is no alternative. There is no difference. Whereas, you know, now, you know, post 9/11, and especially now, the situation will be good. Well, now there are alternatives, both externally and internally. And that causes a great deal of anxiety.
Yeah, I thought, because I looked into, I don't consider myself like a connoisseur of the 90s or anything. I do consider myself like very interested in very niche musical tastes in the early, specifically the early 90s. I'm kind of like, kind of pretentious in that regard. But for the Gulf War in particular, especially considering your and my interest in media theory and the philosophy of media, when I was looking into the Gulf War, it was apparently one of the, or it was the first live sort of broadcast wars. I know that, yeah, there was, I mean, there were, I mean, there obviously have been wars before then that were broadcast on television, but before then they'd never been live broadcast. And apparently they learned, or the U.S. military learned a lot about how to manage the image of, you know, relating a war to its citizens from the Vietnam War, right? They learned a lot of, because the Vietnam War got a lot of pushback from the way that it was covered, not specifically like from the way it was covered, but I suppose, you know, a first time out, they didn't really know what they were doing as far as trying to prop up.
The U.S. government was not stoked upon reflection about how the Vietnam War was reported by various media outlets and journalists, which means obviously more controlled and contrived and integrated, right? Like really integrating the media machine into the political military machine so that it now becomes an appendage of that. You see that really drawn out in like Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff like that. And the ways, particularly Iraq is really interesting in the way that it's like constantly reported that like things are going good and like we're, you know, six, you know, the fame. And then, you know, obviously there's the famous Bush on the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished sign and all this kind of stuff. Even though like, once you start to look into it, people in retrospect, like from right from the beginning, like with, is particularly in Iraq, people were like, you know, people were both in the military and outside observers were like ringing alarm bells, like what you guys are doing, number one, like your reasons for doing it are not legit, but also too, like the way you're actually operating on the ground is like, not only is it unethical, but it's also like inefficient and causing, you're making the situation worse. Like you're actively making the situation worse. And that kind of stuff was just like not being reported on and not being engaged with because of the kind of control and activity that the political and military industrial complex had within the media system.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine, because I imagine that must have come from their experience with the Gulf War.
For sure. They took that experience from the Gulf War and transposed it over. But that whole experience comes from, obviously, from Vietnam, right? Like, where, you know, you've got, you know, reporters just kind of on the ground, like hanging out with troops unsupervised, being like, oh, you guys are like killing civilians now? Like, I guess we'll tell everybody about this.
I haven't read, Jean Baudrillard, I suppose, is someone who you know, when you look into starting to read philosophy, you encounter his I think it's called Simulacra and Simulation. You encounter that text, but I think he wrote a book called The Gulf. It had some, its essential thesis was that the Gulf War didn't happen because it was the first war that was operating according to these sort of media methods. That I haven't read it. He's kind of like the one, I guess I shouldn't say that he's like the one who I'm still kind of like intimidated by his aura from, even though I've like crashed down all kinds of auras around other difficult thinkers. But I have tried to approach Baudrillard before, and I remember him being impenetrable. But I know that while we're talking about, you know, the Gulf War in the context of philosophy, you had to bring up Baudrillard saying that the Gulf War didn't happen.
You know, I know a little bit about Baudrillard, not a lot, but particularly the simulacra of simulation. I think we can say that an interesting part of the Gulf War, and probably one of the more concerning things to come out of the 90s vibes, the simulation becomes more real than, you know, the hyper-reality. And what we mean by that with the Gulf War is, what do you say, oh, the Gulf War didn't happen? I haven't read the work. But what I'll take away from that is, we, just like how we brought up the Gulf War, it's like we bring up the guys with the cookie dough suits and the, you know, when the oil, the burning oil wells and, you know, great American success and blah, 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 right? All of that is a narrative media creation that is now the Gulf War, right? That is now, you know, people talk Desert Storm, blah, blah, blah. That's what it is, right? Like, it's the simulated variation that was created through media methodology that has become far more real, particularly in a cultural context and in our cultural memory, than the actual war ever was or will be.
That kind of disconnect between the narrative that's been constructed and the facts that, I mean, people, it's, I'm sure that there were facts relayed through the news, but the way that the facts represent a particular way that events unfolded from a particular perspective.
And I think about how that kind of stuff relates to like our current media landscape and what we engage with, where it really, mediums really have become all just hyper reality, right? Like a proportion of stories and narratives that are so thickly lain and so universally taken up that that whatever truth they were based off of becomes impenetrable. You know, the example that I think about for our current time is the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing and Jeffrey Epstein and Trump and all this kind of stuff. But because this thing has become so steeped in effectively like a media circus and reporting and story, that it becomes incredibly difficult as a layperson just observing media to have any sort of faith or belief or understanding of what's going on. Chaos and confusion is, and the suspicion is, I think in many ways, the intention. And it also becomes, on the one hand, it becomes a spectacle. And on the other hand, it can become tiresome and boring and disengaging, right? Like basically you kind of step away, you walk away, you say, well, I don't know. Like there's nothing I can like actually work with here. So I'm just not even going to bother. Or you buy into the whole just right-left media story and reporting of the whole thing. And you kind of like commit to one of those stories, but you can't really, you know, ever know, especially when things are so steeped in conspiracy and all this kind of stuff.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada. And we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.